and that sight carries its message into the brain. And that here the brain orients it, thinks about it, meditates upon it, accepts or rejects according to its own pleasure. This is not true. All sight function, or all other sensory function, is first of all an agitation, a conditioned agitation within the etheric field. The ethers carry the impressions directly across their bridge to the corresponding part of man himself, not the body. Therefore, certain emotional messages are carried to the emotional parts of the person in the body, and mental messages to the mental part. It is this person that then passes the energy equivalents back again through the brain or through the liver to become objectively known in the material personality. This process is exceedingly rapid. It is so rapid that the average individual could not even measure it or estimate it. As far as we are concerned, the process is instantaneous. But actually, it is instantaneous because this entire mystery is suspended in a sea of constant vibration. And this vibration is ever flowing against the two shores, the person above and the body below. And this vibration, therefore, carries its message constantly to both of its extreme polarities. And these polarities participate in activities of all kinds because of this energy field. Now let us suppose for a moment, in thinking of this, that we now have the compound vital body with its four essential functions. That this vital body, according to Hindu philosophy, after death of the physical body, takes on the appearance and general attributes of the previous physical embodiment. That it remains for a time, usually not too great a length of time, until all of these energy records are transformed or returned to the person. After that, the vital body itself disintegrates. The vital body having no essential meaning other than that of a conveyor or a messenger. It is not the source of any creativity of its own. It is simply a carrier, a wire-like medium through which energy moves, or upon which energy is transmitted. This vehicle of transmission, however, must precede and survive a time, the physical body with which it is associated, because it is responsible in very large measure for the building up of this body, and it is also responsible for the sensitivity of the body to the impulses and will of the person who inhabits it. Thus, the vital body is very closely and inevitably associated with health. And I think we can begin to understand why it is associated with health when we realize that it is compelled, regardless of inclination, which it does not have, to faithfully convey whatever be the mood, whatever be the conviction or the attitude of the person. It is inevitably and instantly conveyed to the body and distributed through centers appropriate to such purposes. It naturally follows that a complete mental or emotional intemperance on the part of the person will ultimately work a serious and desperate hardship upon the body, which must constantly respond as best it can and according to the faculties that it possesses to the insistent demands of the person. Thus, the person is a tyrant over its own body, unless it has learned and come to understand its debt, its responsibility, and the value of this body, which is its link with objectivity. Without this body and its etheric methods of communication, there could be no objective link between the person and the material universe. Thus, the vital body is the channel by which man conquers the world. And it is also the vehicle or means by which man perfects his awareness of the world. It is by means of this body that man imposes his will upon physical matter or physical body. And it is also by means of this that the needs, requirements, and desperate circumstances of the physical body are brought to the attention of the person. We find this, for example, in the case of danger, where the danger to the physical body being real and apparent, there is an instinctive reflex of protection. The person takes over and attempts to save his body. Conversely, there are times in which the body, apparently, has to come to the aid of the person, and it may do so by temporarily blocking a function in order to prevent a dangerous abuse or misuse of power. The body can become, therefore, the prison of the individual who misuses it as a house. And wherever we have an abuse of function or an abuse of power, we have elements of retribution creeping in. Not because the body consciously wishes to punish, it has no such awareness, but because nature inevitably punishes abuse, and the body is the victim. And because of its structure, it can only take a certain degree of misuse. Then it becomes incapable of continued normal function. This is the punishment, that the body which has been exploited can no longer be depended upon to function normally. Realizing that these links, therefore, bind the person to the body, we begin to understand something about disease that we didn't perhaps think of before. Namely, that disease is actually the physical symptomology or symbolism of vibratory excess within the person. Disease is nearly always the direct result of emotional or mental pressures. We are beginning to sense this on a psychological level, but we do not know why. What we have to learn is that the vibratory rates, which are negative, and which are rising with intensity in the person, particularly in his mental and emotional life, that these are inevitably transferred by the ethers to the body. And these excesses pollute the body, or demand of it some strange and unnatural activity. And this, in turn, destroys the harmony of relationships between the person and the body. It naturally also follows, therefore, that the person in the body does not suffer from the diseases of the body. Therefore, essentially, an individual who, for some reason, is mentally ill only in the terms of being brain ill, so far as physical diagnosis is concerned. In other words, the mental and emotional natures are not capable or susceptible to insanity as we know it. But very often, the physical sickness of the mind is due to psychic patterns, complexes, frustrations, and neuroses, which are the psychic equivalents of ailments. These existing within the person must inevitably stamp themselves upon the body, ether becoming again the channel for this inevitable interchange. Now, as we go further with this particular phase of our subject, we begin to come on a number of other interesting points. The total etheric field, of which we are so primarily concerned, has its own direct role through which it enters into the bodily economy. And this road is the spleen. Therefore, the spleen actually acts almost like the elaborate antenna of a radio or television set, or as one of these magnificent instruments used to detect the approach of strange aircraft. It picks up and carries into a physical structure of the spleen the records or impressions of the entire etheric field. Therefore, it is said that the linga sharira in Hindu philosophy lies coiled in the liver. And here, we may say that it becomes the absolute administrator of energy. Thus, certain ailments which affect, pardon me, in the coil in the spleen, this spleen therefore, is associated with energy depletions. And certain serious ailments of the spleen may gradually result in forcing the vital body out of adequate function. This, in turn, will result gradually in the loss of energy content. The spleen, being this umbrella-like organ, which picks up the total etheric vibration for distribution, must then immediately channel it to the principal centers other than itself, these centers being primarily the brain, the heart, and the liver. The central area of the spleen itself, with its magnetic field, extends into the abdominal area and impinges upon the great semilunar ganglia, which are the peculiar instruments of the sympathetic nervous system. The spleen, therefore, does have great meaning. And we know that we have a term of relating to spleen as relating to anger or to discontent or to excitement or agitation. In ancient times, magicians believed that evil entities entered the body through the spleen. They therefore took all possible precautions to protect this part of the body by their formulas and by their talismans and by their various magical equipments and devices. Now here we have an interesting problem. We have man with a body derived from the elements, a physical body, with a superphysical being derived from the higher levels or planes of nature, and a connecting link derived from the etheric vehicle of nature itself. In other words, man's physical body is bound to the physical body of the world, his etheric to the etheric body of the world, his emotional to the emotional body, and his mental to the mental body of the world. Therefore, man possesses, first of all, mind, which is in turn the result of a binder between the mental nature and a superior world. And he has a brain, which is the result of a binder between the mental nature and an inferior world. This mind stands in man as supported by the universal principle of intellect. And brain stands supported by the personal principle of mind. Thus, in every part of the universe, there is an absolute order and a descent from universals to particulars. And in this descent, man's physical body is the basket which catches all the particulars, and by which these particulars are manifested forth on various levels of activity. In the Eastern system, therefore, the control and direction of prana, or the vital energy of the body, became extremely important. And now we must go into certain other attributes of ether. Just as the average person does not recognize any need for a vehicle other than the physical, and looking in the mirror, sees his face and calls it himself, so essentially, the etheric body, if accepted, becomes a substitute for everything superior to itself. If one of these days science discovers for certain, and without further reservation, the reality of a vital principle behind man, called the etheric double, science will then announce that it has discovered all. It will decide that mind, emotion, and action, everything, originate in this etheric field. Just as today, science is inclined to think that thought is the result of a certain reactive, psychoelectrical, biochemical process within the brain. Once the etheric field isn't fully understood, it will be blamed for everything, held responsible for everything, and be regarded as the true explanation to everything. The old Hindu teachers were well aware of this also. And they realized that in their disciplines with their disciples, that the disciple who became aware of ether and became aware of the existence of his own vital body was not certain for a moment whether or not he had come face to face with God. Because the vital body, being an instrument of vibration, taking upon itself the coloration of the person behind it, and therefore being the immediate revealer of thought and emotion and vitality, seemed to be the very source of these things. also recognizing another important factor, and that is the power of thought upon the ether. We come upon a series of very interesting interrelated circumstances. Mind is superior to ether, obviously, because that which is superior uses the inferior for a channel, and the channel cannot be greater than the thing which it channels, or else the position of the two would be reversed. Consequently, the human thought process has a great deal more influence on the etheric substances than upon material substances. This is perhaps one of the reasons why mental healing, thought healing, faith healing have been recognized since the very earliest time. It has been demonstrated that these etheric patterns can be and are affected by the conscious thought and will of the individual. This is particularly and dramatically true of emotional ether. And to the individual who is experimenting with this substance, the emotional energy and its etheric character, carrier can be identified or considered to be one. We are not yet well enough advanced in this form of abstract metaphysics to be with certainty able to differentiate them. Thus, what do we have? We have the possibility of almost anything happening within the etheric structure, because this structure can take on, temporarily, a variety of fantasies induced by imagination or belief. One of the most common problems we find in connection with Oriental philosophies dealing with this subject is the substitution of ether for what may be termed the higher bodies of the person. The etheric bodies of thought and emotion are therefore regarded as thought and emotion, when in reality they are merely subtle carriers of it. Here is an example of what we mean. The etheric double is the archetype of the body. Therefore, it is the direct mold into which the body is cast. Every organ and structure has its etheric duplicate. Therefore, there must be an etheric heart, which corresponds to the physical heart, an etheric liver, an etheric lungs, an etheric blood circulation. These things, on a molecular level, correspond exactly. The superior principles of man, however, are not essentially molecular. They are what we would term today atomic. And the old Hindus, in their Indian atomistic schools, back 1,500 years ago, were already playing with the atomic theory, as were the Greeks. And they realized that the various bodies of man are all composed of substances, and that these substances have natures and identities of their own, and that there is no vehicle that is not substantial of some kind. That alone is unbodied or insubstantial, which is infinite life itself. Everything else must have vehicles, and these vehicles are containers created for the distribution of a universal energy. So in man, for example, we have a physical nervous system and an etheric nervous system. Under normal conditions, the etheric structure gives no trouble unless the physical structure is brought into an inharmonious relationship with it. Simple example. Supposing you place an orange or a hard golf ball under your arm. Press down upon it until you stop circulation. If you do so, the arm will go to sleep. It goes to sleep because the etheric current is cut off. And therefore, the etheric body has a complete subsistence apart from the material. And the destruction or loss of the etheric, of the physical member, will not disrupt or destroy its etheric double. Lord Nelson told a story relating to that, in which he said that after he had lost his arm, he frequently felt it, and that there was nothing else that convinced him so completely that man had a superphysical constitution as the fact that the arm that wasn't there could hurt.
The etheric double, therefore, is also an arm, and if the physical arm is destroyed, the etheric double continues to exist, even if the method of its destruction of the physical arm is by a sharp instrument. This will scar or injure the etheric double, but not destroy it, but could be responsible, in the case of Nelson, for the pain which continued to be felt etherically. On this basis of thinking, and the ancients were pretty well agreed on it, we therefore realize that man can have etheric stomach trouble and physical stomach trouble. And that technically, therefore, unless the stomach difficulty is due to poison or to the introduction of some dangerous substance into the body, that the stomach trouble is most likely to be first etheric and then physical. The etheric stomach trouble being generally described as butterflies, or nervousness, or something which injures the normal function of the stomach. Thus, derangements due to psychic stress from the emotions and thoughts first affect the etheric organs, and then from the etheric organs are passed into the material. If the material organs are injured, the etheric may continue to function. Then function physically is not possible because of the injury to the material form, not to the depletion or loss of the etheric double. In this way, we are also susceptible, however, to a series of rather interesting conditions. Consider for a moment the etheric equivalent to the human cerebrospinal nervous system. This tremendous network of nerves arising from this bulb-like root in the brain and extending like the branches, twigs, and leaves of an immense tree throughout the body, which is almost indeed the tree of life. This tree, with its innumerable branches and its innumerable filaments, becomes a vast, radiant energy field, in which the tree form is more perceptible than it is with the physical nervous system. Here we could discover it by dissection, if we were able to dissect the tiny filaments. But when they are radiant with internal life, we can see them when they're much too small to see in the physical structure. If then we assume for a moment that this is the case, we then discover that in the etheric structure we have what the Hindu in his Eastern philosophy calls the etheric double of the Kundali Shakti, or the great mystery of the chakras, or the entire set of nerve ganglia extending from the base of the brain upward to the thousand petal lotus at the crown of the head. This system of chakras is tremendously involved in yoga. But needless to say, the true chakras and their energies are not etheric. The true set of chakras passes through the entire septenary constitution of man, but they do have their equivalents totally within the etheric body. The majority of cases in which efforts to develop the Kundali Shakti by those who are not under adequate discipline does not have a thing to do with this mysterious serpent power. Because whether we like to realize it or not, we should know that this power is not under the control of foolish, stupid, ignorant human beings. No individual with three lessons and a poor teacher is going to loosen the entire mystery of universal energy upon himself. He couldn't do it. Nature has many too many breaks upon this power, preventing it from the possibility of being so tremendously abused. But the individual can cause a symbolic representation of this process in the etheric double. And he can have all kinds of symptoms. Symptoms that are not real. Symptoms that simply arise from the disturbances caused in his energy fields by unwise and injudicious actions. If we add to this his own imagination, he can get himself into a pretty serious dilemma. But it does not mean that actually he has been able to pass through these mysterious gates that protect him. because actually the original and basic power of the second chakra from the bottom locks the every part of the field above the etheric. Therefore, the individual cannot possibly accidentally get into it. But he can have all the symptoms. He can have all the apparent experiences. And should he have a slight amount of etheric perception, he may even think he can see it. But what is actually being disturbed is the etheric field. And because this field could appear to him to be a tremendous mystery, he seldom asks more, and is content to assume that things are as they seem to be, which is a dangerous assumption in the invisible universe, just as it is in the visible universe. Things are not always what they seem to be. Now, going further into this problem of ether, we discover, for example, that the etheric structure carries what Bhimi, the mystic, calls the signatura rerum, or the true seal of the king. This is the impression of its own etheric pattern, infinitely repeated in structure. Leonardo realized that growth in nature is an infinite repetition of an identical theme. That this theme is variously specialized, differing in various parts of its appearance, but one master formula underlies the whole thing. Therefore, in man, the etheric energies and etheric principles are constantly stamping themselves upon parts as symbolic of the whole. Thus, if we possess the knowledge, possess the understanding, we can capture the total picture from any of its parts. Experimentation recently has shown, for example, that the individual can convey the total psychology or integration of himself through his own etheric field into any substance that he touches or contacts or comes near to. If a person moves through a room, his etheric record remains there for a time, because the vibration causes the natural energies in the room to harmonize with this new vibration for a short time as it passes through. Gradually, this pattern will die out, but it can be conceivable that it could be captured within a given length of time. An individual breathing into a glass of water will leave an image of his psychic field there. An individual who wears any garments or clothing for any length of time will also impregnate them with this etheric pattern, which is essentially a rate of vibration. It is also quite certain that every drop of blood in the human body will crystallize according to the total etheric picture of the individual, and therefore, theoretically, can be used for the diagnosis of disease. In fact, it has been used at various times. The study of the etheric body of man leads us inevitably to consider the etheric body of the earth, with which the functions and faculties of man are so closely related. We know that the earth's magnetic field, like that of the human being, is a medium or a carrier, by means of which the solar energy can be accepted by a planet and can be transformed and distributed through that planet in various ways suitable to the maintenance of life. Thus, a planet has a heart, a brain, a liver, lungs, everything that any body needs for function. But because the total purpose of a planet is different, the structure and use of these faculties, functions, and organs will naturally be different. We cannot see them, we will never discover them per se. But we know that just as man distributes energy through these certain distinct instruments, so the planet also has them. And that the earth also has zones or areas in which the etheric emanations are particularly powerful. We know, for example, that as the vital body has certain areas, particularly its poles, in which there is tremendous electrical activity. The same is true of the earth, where the electrical polarities are represented to us or recognized by us through the aurora borealis and the aurora australis. That the earth is also an etheric instrument, and that through this etheric instrument, life is supported on the earth. For man is on the earth because within the earth itself, or in its atmosphere, or in its own invisible body zones, the four ethers are operating perpetually. And these ethers, therefore, constitute always the links between body and being. And as they serve the earth as its link with the sun, so they serve man in his link with the self, or the being which is the center of his mysterious solar system, or the system of his soul. We also know that in different areas, in various parts of the earth, these magnetic zones are of various strengths. We know that physical ether, for example, is associated with the earth as a crystal, and is responsible for certain inevitable lines of fission within the earth, which in the case of the total compound earth we call faults. We know also that the discharge of energy from the heaviside layer of the earth's atmosphere may cause these faults to move, resulting in earthquakes. We know also that discharges of etheric energy within man can produce parallel incidents or circumstances. The study of man, therefore, gives us a clue to the study of nature, and vice versa. For whatever happens in nature is in some way happening in man. Man is also bound by the ethers to a number of other important things. Paracelsus von Hohenheim told us that man derives his spiritual energy from the stars, his intellectual energy from the planets, and his physical energy from the earth, or the elements. Therefore, all of these are bridged to him by means of his etheric field. It is because of his etheric field, as Paracelsus pointed out, that there is a universe in man, that there are solar systems within him, that he is a solar system, because he is bound by this tremendous archetypal pattern. And this archetypal pattern, which is causal in principle, first molds ether, and then ether molds body. So between all archetypes and their fulfillment must be ether. Now let's take that on another level of activity. A man decides to draw a picture. In his mind he has a picture in contemplation. On an easel before him stands a canvas, and on a stand the necessary paint and brushes. Therefore, here is the man, here are the elements and the materials, but as yet no picture. Now how is this idea to be transformed into a picture? The idea, like the invisible causal nature of man, can be perfect in itself as far as complete or integrated is concerned. The artist may know exactly what he intends to paint. The materials are entirely adequate. And yet without a bridge between the two, what happens? Nothing. Now in the case of the artist, what is the bridge? Of course, the most immediate and natural answer is his hand. He's going to pick up the brushes, squeeze some paint on the palette, and go to work. But activity is the link. Because without energy, he couldn't move his hand. Without vitality, he could not pick up the paint. Without the emotional ether, he would be unable to integrate the meaning of his picture. Without the vital ether, he could not distinguish the color of the pigments. And without the mental ether, he could not hold the design in consciousness. Therefore, all these ethers have to take part in the preparation of the transference of the picture from the mind to the canvas. This is constantly occurring with every activity of man. But actually, the simplest statement is that without energy, the picture cannot be painted. So between every abstraction and its concrete fulfillment is a demand upon energy. Man likes to assume that energy is infinite. And probably, in a large sense of the word, energy is infinite. Why then cannot man continually call upon it? What is the relation, for example, between the etheric body and age? Why is it that these energies cannot perpetually sustain beings like the fuel in the ever-burning lamp of the alchemist, or Frida's wonderful wheel of perpetual motion? The answer, of course, goes back to a very simple thing. Action ultimately breaks down substance. The constant action of the body wears it out. Now we know that to a degree, this activity can be slowed down. We know, for example, that considering the infancy and childhood of man, that man should live much longer than he does. Incidentally, physical ether has complete control of his life up to the 7th year. From the 7th to the 14th, vital ether. From the 14th to the 21st, emotional ether. And from the 21st to the 28th, mental ether. From the 28th to the 35th, physical ether takes over again, and the cycle is repeated until the end of life is reached. These ethers, therefore, have a certain particular and important part to play. But why does not man continue to exist if he has a cosmic fuel tank behind him that can never be empty? You may as well say, why doesn't an automobile run forever as long as Standard Oil continues to have petrol? It is not the fuel which is the key to survival. The key to survival is the overcoming of conflict in the relationship of the being and his body. The fuel is only the means of communication and the transportation of concepts. The fuel makes activity possible, but is not responsible for the quality of that activity. It must convey the message, whether it wants to or not, or whether the message is right or wrong. Now it happens that the physical body of man is a compound held together by a physical ether. It is the nature of compounds that they shall be dissolved. And from the moment of birth, man's compound is subjected to a strain which will ultimately bring about its dissolution. This strain is activated and increased by the unreasonable relationships between the person and his body. Ether supplies energy as long as body is capable of assimilating it, or unless body, that's in body, the centers necessary for the distribution of this energy are undermined or destroyed. In almost every instance, a study indicates that these centers are prematurely destroyed by the intemperance of the individual. He does not take proper care of his body. He does not make proper use of his energy factors. He dedicates the body to the fulfillment of the purpose of the will. Therefore, he is throughout life forever sacrificing body to intent, and to a large measure, to intensity. That which is most frequently used or driven at an unreasonable speed will be the first to break down. A car that is driven unreasonably will need repair sooner than another car. In fact, it can be hopelessly destroyed as an invaluable possession by reckless driving. It is the same with the driver behind man. This driver can so afflict the body that by degrees the ability of the physical centers set up for the purpose to transmit energy, this ability is undermined. These centers no longer respond to the vibration of the vital ether. They harden. They become less subtle until finally they no longer pick up the energy. The energy then continues to flow. These structures are bathed in it. But they do not respond. Devitalization does not mean that eternal life is deprived. It means that by degrees the individual destroys the power of his own structure to accept and distribute energy. to prevent this. Philosophy, particularly Eastern philosophy, has advocated the kind of life that reduces wear and tear to a minimum. It cautions against intemperance and excess of all kinds. It points out that tranquility, relaxation, the quiet, normal acceptance of life, the quiet, purposeful, organized administration of living, that these, by their natural, conserving factors, will normally lengthen life expectancy and decrease the expectancy of inefficiency. Whenever crystallization reaches a certain point, it will not respond to energy at all. It is simply like a radio set in which there is some serious defect so that it does not pick up the program. But as the program fades out with the collapsing tube, it has no evidence in this that the program in the station has faded out, or that there is any break in the continuity of the broadcasting process. Devitalization is therefore man gradually separating himself from his energy fields, separating himself because of his failure to maintain the bodily structure in a way in which it can pick up or respond to energy. Paracelsus worked on this theory also, and he also worked on the idea that by means of talismanic articles, it was possible to attract energy to the body. The Paracelsian theory, for example, of metallic medicines was based upon the ancient cosmological concept of the association of the planets with the metals. Therefore, gold was an energy-invoking power. Silver was a powerful agent for the stimulation of what may be termed emotional energy, or the gathering of it. Iron for a certain kind of structural energy. Thus, material of this kind, when introduced into the body, would call magnetic polarities from space. These metals would set up magnets. And he went on to explain that what we call a pole in the body to receive ether is actually a kind of magnet which draws and accepts and discriminates between etheric energies. It holds those energies which it needs, and the others are permitted to continue. And those energies which are not at all useful to man may be captured and held by a plant or an animal. Still others may be captured and held by beings and creatures that we have never thought about until the rise of science fiction. But in any event, these energies are picked up by the magnetic fields. If these fields are depleted, we have loss of the power to capture and hold energy. Well, what might, for instance, deplete the supply of gold in the human system? We know man has all of the elements in him in very minute amounts, and that these are important in calling energies to him. The rapid and unreasonable exhaustion of the gold content through the reckless extravagance of the use of the energy which it represents may result in debility. If this debility is permitted to go on, it may exhaust the magnetic core of gold within the body and make it impossible for the body to call upon space and the atmosphere and life to replenish its gold supply. Thus, these polarities, if exhausted, deprive man of the future availability of the substance, unless it is introduced by some artificial or magnetic means. Also, the exhaustion of any element within the body and the destruction thereby of a magnetic field has something to do with the excretion of the body. For these magnetic fields are also responsible for taking to themselves and literally transmuting waste materials. Therefore, if they are depleted, they cannot cleanse the zones and areas with which their energies are associated. Thus, we have the rise of poison and the rise of toxin, because we have depleted a part of an elaborate system of interrelationships by which man is constantly being fed by space and is casting back into space the waste materials which he can no longer use. Whenever a bodily structure or function necessary to this process is impaired, a part of death sets in. And a great deal of our so-called most serious disease, type of disease, is local death. It is death which is going to spread from one small area of tissue until finally it corrupts perhaps the entire body or destroys the function of a complete organ. This death is always due to one thing, the cutting off of ether. But while the etheric energy is there, life is there. And where this etheric energy can make its entrances and its exits, it will constantly preserve the economy of parts. So that this whole energy, with all of its phases, is nutritional. Nursing, feeding, nourishing, emotion and thought. This energy also is constantly symbolizing its needs in various ways, producing what we call symptoms. And symptoms relate not only to organs or parts of the body, but to qualities or conditions within the compound constitution. Years ago, we always treated the sick where the pain was. Today, we no longer do so, because we realize that the pain may be at one end of the body and the cause at the other. We know now that symptoms spread, and we know that the whole body becomes a symbolic field for diagnosis. For this reason, when Paracelsus discovered, for example, that the spleen, the great gateway of etheric energy, was being impaired, he placed a gold ring on the little finger of the left hand, because he realized that that was what was called the splenic finger. And that in some mysterious way there was a direct relationship between the etheric field of the spleen and the emanations from the magnetic poles of the little finger. If it was the emotional ether that was disturbed through the liver, he put a ring of an entirely different material, tin, on this little finger of the right hand, which he found to be the liver finger. Now, it's quite impossible for us to assume that there are liver fingers and gall thumbnails and things of that nature. That gets us into a little bit of complication. But let us recognize that man is this tremendous electromagnetic field. The currents meet, mingle, separate, and have their numerous courses throughout him at all times. We know, for example, that the hand has always been directly associated with life, with vitality. Perhaps due in part to man's mental association. Today and for ages, the hand has been the servant of the mind. The hand must therefore be in some way capable of a full interpretation of the compound requirements of the four ethers. And the ancients discovered that this was possible through the four fingers, and that the mysterious fifth ether, or kasher of the Hindus, was the thumb. And that symbolically, these fingers, by their natural motions, by their structure, by their coloration, by their nails, by the markings upon them, were in some way directly related to the basic energy fields of the human body. This may not seem quite so unreasonable if you assume it to be possible that the character and destiny of individuals can be read from the lines in the hand. Cairo, Count Harmon, believed this was because there was an artery which went directly from the heart to the hand, and therefore that the hand as the particular symbol of man and his purpose. For man became man when he created a hand. That this particular purpose became psychosomatically symbolized throughout his magnetic structure, and that therefore practically every type of energy in the body converges into the hands.
because these, of all parts of man, are most subtly responsive. If you have ever watched the fingers of a great musician, you will realize the tremendous, incredible control which direct thought, without conscious volition, has upon the hands. With such control, it is not unreasonable either to assume that certain Hindu physicians diagnose patients by simply inviting them to sit down and talk with them. The doctor then watches the patient's hands and by his gestures diagnoses the ailment and can tell almost any problem that arises simply by which finger the man moves first, in what direction, and what the gesture may be. Because the gesture in some way is a revelation of the total life of the person. Thus the ether is infinitely stamping its total message on everything, on every drop of blood, on the iris of the eye, into every hair. This is, if it was not for this tremendous totality of etheric distribution, man would not have the power of speech. He would not be able to transmute almost instantly thought into a verbal structure. He would not be able to control intuitively all of the sensory perceptions and faculties which he possesses. Thus ether is forever active, forever carrying the message. And one of its attributes is said to be that of a living photographic plate. For it is forever photographing purposes and projecting them upon structures. And through this constant projection, the etheric body maintains the tremendous intensity of activity which we call physical life. A very intricate and wonderful process. A process with which we can cooperate by attempting to preserve the relaxation and integration of the body in order that it may respond without necessary compulsion to any instinct or impulse of the etheric energy. And also by training the person in the body not to issue commands or demands that are unreasonable. If these two ends are met, then ether will continue to impress the person upon the body symbolically and maintain the body as a constant and consistent instrument of that purpose. So through ether, the physical body of man becomes a living thing and as such becomes the instrument of the destiny of the person that lives within it. I think that's enough for one warm evening.